Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. For those of you who haven't been here before, we do have one case on our 9 o'clock docket and one case on our 10:30 docket, so we will proceed through case number one, then we'll take a short recess before picking up the second case on our docket. The first case is Dinar Restaurants versus King. If the clerk will please announce counsel, he'll be arguing. All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Tanner, you may proceed as soon as you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This case presents a question as to whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in overruling an employer's motion to compel arbitration. We believe that under federal and state law, which governs under the Federal Arbitration Act, the trial court clearly abused its discretion in this instance by failing to apply and correctly apply the governing legal principles. This particular case involves an arbitration plan titled Mutual Agreement to Arbitrate, which the trial court found the appellee, Ms. King, received on or about October 11, 2010. She then left the workplace and resigned her employment effective October 20, as the record reflects. The particular arbitration provision which the trial court focused on was the effective date provision. The effective date of the mutual agreement to arbitrate claims was defined to include the employee's commencement of work at the company and would become effective either before the commencement of work or alternatively the effective date would occur 10 calendar days after the employee received notice of the terms and conditions and continued to work. That is in section one of the mutual agreement to arbitrate. There is a provision also that pertains to the effective date and covered claims in section 11 of the agreement, the term, and it states that in part that the agreement shall survive the employer-employee relationship between company and employee and shall apply to any covered claim, whether it arises or is asserted during or after termination of the employee's employment with the company or the expiration of any benefit plan. And these claims were asserted after, of course, Ms. King left her employment with Dinar Restaurants in January of 2011. And some of the claims that have been asserted arose after the termination of employment. So there is an ambiguity as to what the effective date of the agreement was in this particular instance. Of course, with respect to the Federal Arbitration Act, Section 3 of the agreement states that the FAA governs all aspects of the agreement, and I do not believe that Ms. King contests the application of the FAA in this case. The United States Supreme Court has observed on a number of occasions that the FAA leaves no place for the exercise of discretion by a trial court, none, zero, but instead mandates that the trial court shall direct the parties to proceed to arbitration on issues to which an arbitration agreement has been signed. In this case, Ms. King denied signing a receipt of the arbitration agreement on October the 11th. The Dinar Restaurants was required to retain the services of a handwriting expert. The trial court did find that she received the arbitration agreement on that date. Dinar Restaurant's position was simply that she received the agreement before she commenced work. The commencement of work is not defined. That was for the arbitrator to determine. However, the trial court construed the definitional language in the agreement and construed the effective date provision to indicate that the commencement of work began at the time she began or entered into the orientation session at which she received the agreement. And we respectfully submit that that was a decision for the arbitrator, in this instance, not the trial court. Indeed, the presumption of arbitrability under the FAA is so strong, as the Supreme Court said that in the Moses Cone Memorial Hospital case, quote, any doubts concerning the scope of arbitrable issues should be resolved in favor of arbitration, whether the problem at hand is the construction of the contract language itself or an allegation of waiver, delay, or like defense to arbitrability. And then when you look at the famous Steelworkers trilogy arising in the context of labor arbitration, but principles which the U.S. Supreme Court has applied consistently in all types of civil disputes and involving arbitration agreements, there the court said that trial courts must defer to arbitration, quote, unless it may be said with positive assurance that the arbitration clause is not susceptible of an interpretation that covers the asserted dispute. Doubts should be resolved in favor of coverage.
Okay, but counsel, may I interrupt a moment, please?
Yes. Thank you, Justice.
That presumption doesn't apply when we're determining whether an agreement has come into existence, does it? We don't apply that until we get to the scope.
I think here the court, this is a very broad arbitration clause, and effectively what the court did was construe the language of the agreement to make a determination of arbitrability. There are two possible interpretations of the agreement, plausible interpretations, reasonable interpretations that the agreement did become effective and was in effect at the time these claims arose. One interpretation was that she received the agreement before she commenced work, which was not defined in the agreement. And the other interpretation is that the agreement became effective on the 10th day, whether or not she was employed under Section 11 of the agreement. All the essential elements of contract formation were clearly proved and presented to the trial court. The trial court made no finding that there were any defects with respect to the identification of the parties. The trial court expressly stated, I'm not concerned about consideration that exists here. The subject matter of the agreement is clearly covered. The trial court found that Ms. King acknowledged receipt of the agreement, which under Texas law is strong evidence that she assented to its terms, as we've briefed in our, especially in the reply brief. So the court was really not addressing contract formation here, although that's the language that the court had to use to make its finding. The court was addressing arbitrability.
Do those two things really differ under this scenario? Because there's nothing in this arbitration agreement that says you're required to arbitrate whether you have a valid arbitration agreement, whether it was in effect at the time that whatever occurrence occurred.
In Rent-A-Center, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the parties may delegate exclusive authority to the arbitrator to determine even whether an agreement is enforceable in the first instance. And this agreement clearly does that.
This isn't really enforceability. It's whether it was in effect, whether it applied. That's a different question.
It is a different question, perhaps, and that's a question for the arbitrator. As
our briefing. Where does it say that in the arbitration agreement, that's a question for the arbitrator? It's not under 5C, which I think is what you cite in your brief, because that talks simply about the scope.
I think 5C does apply to whether there's any covered claim must be determined by the arbitrator.
But we don't get to that unless the agreement was effective by went into effect under Section 1.
That's to me a
question of state contract law under Texas Supreme Court cases.
I think under the circumstances, because the court could not say with positive assurance that it does not cover these particular claims and was not in effect, the court made an error of law and misapplied the law under Rent-A-Center and the Texas cases that follow Rent-A-Center. We've cited, for example, the Iturraldi case that indicates that even gateway issues of validity may be delegated to the arbitrator to decide. And this is an extremely broad clause. This agreement incorporated, among other things, the AAA arbitration rules. The AAA rules say that the arbitrator shall have the power to rule on his or her own jurisdiction, including any objections with respect to existence, scope, or validity of the agreement. So this was an extremely broad, maybe unusually broad, arbitration agreement. And when you have these types of ambiguities, those are to be determined, and they were reserved for the arbitrator. With respect to the arbitrator's authority, the agreement sets out all of the covered claims. It says all covered claims shall be exclusively resolved by binding arbitration. And then the court, in making the decision about contract formation, or using the language of contract formation, actually applied a definition in the agreement concerning course and scope of employment. And an arbitrator may or may not find that Ms. King was in the course and scope of employment when she received the arbitration agreement and then began work. We don't know how that would turn out, but the matter is for the arbitrator exclusively in this particular instance. And, you know, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, has warned in Circuit City Stores against any ruling that erodes FAA jurisprudence by indirection. This would be such an erosion by indirection, by permitting a trial court to basically take definitional language, make the trial court's own interpretation of when the agreement would cover or not cover these particular claims, even though there are other plausible interpretations. And again, the trial court disregarded the broad language, including the fact that AAA rules were incorporated in the agreement. The trial court said at one point, and this is cited in the record, that, quote, it becomes immaterial whether I believe that Ms. King initialed the material or received it, referring to the agreement. But the Texas courts have consistently held that a party's signature on a contract or indicating receipt of a contract is strong evidence that she unconditionally assented to its terms. So offer, acceptance, those are critical elements of contract formation, but the trial court said, well, that doesn't matter to me. That just turns contract formation law in Texas on its head. And I think that shows that and I have great respect for this trial court, but I think in this instance that showed that the trial court really failed to correctly apply principles of contract law under the FAA. We would also suggest that the trial court abused its discretion by excluding Ms. King's prior convictions. There were numerous prior convictions. As our brief pointed out, most of those convictions involved deception, crimes of deception.
Are those in the record?
Yes. We proved up a bill of exception, and we presented all of the certified copy judgments of those convictions. And there was no jury here, so the possibility of prejudice was low. And Texas courts have recognized that crimes of deception have high impeachment value, yet low prejudicial value, while it's crimes of violence that have high prejudicial value. And since Ms. King was the only witness who had personal knowledge of the events, who was available to testify, her testimony was critical to the trial court's determination in this case. And the trial court summarily excluded all of these numerous convictions, including a felony conviction that a felony for procuring a controlled substance by fraud within the past 10 years without an explanation.
There's not really any facts in dispute here concerning she reported on the 11th, did training, got this, signed the form that said she got the arbitration agreement, and her last day at work was the 19th. I mean, that's not really contested, is it?
Well, they pled her last day of work was the 19th. Her last day of work was actually, it became effective the 20th. So there were some facts, and it's what her understanding was. And we believe that she commenced work after she received the arbitration agreement. So that it was, the agreement did become effective.
But 10 days after.
Excuse me? No, we believe that she received it before she commenced work, which would make the agreement effective. There were two ways specified in the agreement that it would become effective. If she received the agreement before she commenced work, or if she accepted the agreement and continued to work, then it would become effective the 10th day thereafter. And again, this conflicts with Section 11, so it's a matter of interpretation that an arbitrator has to rule on, because it's really ultimately an arbitrability issue, not a contract formation question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tanner. Ms. Brandt. May I approach? I have a quick handout. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
And may it please the court. We've already dealt with the fact that this is an abuse of discretion standard. And I think it's very compelling when you look at the record, you see that the trial court exercised a great deal of time and resources in examining this case. Procedurally, I won't go into the entire procedure because it's in the briefs and has been briefed. But the motion to compel, there were two procedural hearings. There was additional briefing, and it ultimately ended up with an evidentiary hearing, following In re Poly and then moving into the evidentiary hearing. The court, as you know, ended up focusing on the foundational portions of the case. He took a full evidentiary hearing. But in the end, he focused on the beginning, on the number one precept of the mutual agreement, which was the effective date, which the justices have looked at as well this morning. The courts have given a gateway on arbitration agreements. And yes, it is true that there is a presumption that we like arbitration in Texas and in the United States. However, we don't get there unless we fulfill the mandates of the courts. In Granite Rock, they talked about this and said that the parties must agree to arbitrate and the court must satisfy itself that the agreement exists and that it is applicable to arbitration. In other words, it must be enforceable. And this is clearly where the trial court focused his attention on the enforceability of the argument. As Mr. Tanner indicated, the trial court took the evidence and even had issues with the testimony. And ultimately he said, I really don't care what the testimony is, because if you don't pass my 10-day rule that's in your agreement, you don't get there. And that is quoted in our brief. Mr. Tanner talked exclusively about contract formation, and we know that under Texas mandates, That's exactly what an arbitration agreement is considered. It is considered a contract, and it's to be construed under contract principles. So ultimately, and the handout that I have given you is a copy of the agreement that we've been talking about. I'm kind of a show me girl. It's easier for me to actually look at what I'm talking about. If you look at it, it talks about two different ways the agreement comes into effect. It can come into effect if it's given to the employee and receives a copy prior to commencing work at the company. Or, and this is what the trial court found, for any other employee, the effective date of this agreement shall occur 10 calendar days after employee receives notice of the terms and conditions of this agreement and employee continues to work for the company, which shall indicate conclusively that she or he or she accepts the terms and conditions of this agreement. In the court's findings, this is exactly what he focused on. In fact, he called it the 10-day rule, and he said, this is what you need. He listened to the testimony. He listened to the credibility arguments. Ms. King testified in her affidavit in the motion to compel, and again on the witness stand, she testified that she commenced work on the 11th. She came to work, was given some papers. Her memory and what she received was not strong, except to the, because she does not believe that she received all of the documents. That was the testimony. She does agree that she signed a receipt that said she received the mutual agreement. If you look at the agreement, first of all, there is no effective date on the agreement itself. So that's an indication, another indication of the 10-day rule. You will also see nowhere a signature on this agreement that Ms. King signed it. But there was a receipt of several employee documents that she signed. She said that she was to be given the documents later. She never got them. The court did not accept that one way or the other, but ultimately said it really doesn't matter. In other words, the 10-day rule is if you don't pass go, you don't get to that testimony.
Was she paid for the first or the 11th? Was she paid?
She was paid beginning on the 11th. That was her first day of pay. And I'm glad you bring that up, because what became interesting in this was that Ms. King was called to testify. But the judge gave the appellant a roadmap. And he said, this is what I need to know that this agreement never comes into effect. And ultimately, he said, so when you get through, you're going to need to brief the legal construction of 10 days after, because it takes you to the 21st. That's the Texas law. The 20th doesn't get you anywhere. Ms. King testified and by affidavit said her last day of an appointment was the 19th. That's 8 days. In the pleadings, it says the 20th. The 20th is the day that she believes she called or asked someone else to call for her, saying that she could not return to work. Either way, you still haven't passed the 10-day rules of the effective date. In furtherance of this argument, the court said, here's what I need, appellant. This is what I need for you to get this arbitration agreement to be effective. Do you have any payroll records? Do you have a witness that can testify that she worked longer than that day? It was never provided. That's in the record at 51.1 through 52.5. Have you reviewed the payroll records in the past, and have you any evidence that she was employed after the 19th? Counsel said, I need to review those records, but they were never produced.
Well, that would be, under your interpretation, that another element of requirement for it to become effective, that she and continues to work, that she continues to work after the 10 days.
Right. She has to work 10 days and has to continue.
Okay.
And I think that makes sense, because the point of these things is notice. An employee should be able to have the decision to make, do I want to keep working for them if I have to do arbitration? I'm not sure how many of them think in those terms, but that's the concept. It's the notice, and the notice, as you know, is in here. It's in the language of that paragraph.
So was it proper for the trial judge to determine this issue of whether it was effective, or was that as appellant argues a question for the arbitrator?
I think what the trial court said was we don't get there. It has to be based on whether it's enforceable from the very beginning. It's not up to the arbitrator. It doesn't go to an arbitrator to say this isn't effective and it goes back to court. It's up to the court to construct the enforceability before it goes to arbitration, or if it goes to arbitration, and in which this case we argue that it does not. It's also important to remember that it was the appellant who drafted this agreement. Mr. Tanner continued to talk about how broad it was, but as the trial court indicated in his findings, when he made his findings at the end of the evidentiary hearing, he said, I find this way, including the fact that this was drafted by appellant. And it is in, I just had it pulled out and I misplaced it. Hang on just a second. Here we go.
Well, it's in the record.
It is in the record, and I was going to quote it to you directly, but it is discussed directly. In addition to that, he talked about ambiguity in interpretation. And I think that as to the ambiguity argument, which is 5C, which the justice talked about, in that case, in that instance, under 5B3, the arbitration agreement specifically excludes a claim or charge with any state or federal agency which would otherwise investigate or pursue a claim or charge such as the EEOC. In this case, Ms. King filed petitions with both the EEOC and the Texas Civil Rights Commission. In both cases, they opted not to investigate but could have and issued letters that allowed her to sue. And again, in 5C, which Mr. Tanner talks about, he talks about that if a claim is covered, it has to go to arbitration, and an arbitrator decides which claims are arbitratable. But the ultimate issue is whether or not it gets to arbitration and the effectiveness of the agreement. And under contract principles, that's exactly what the court argued. And the court didn't argue, the court determined. And that's also in the decision.
Let me ask a question on the receipt document. Apparently there was testimony by your client and then also by an expert witness, handwriting expert.
Yes, ma'am.
When I look at that, I mean, obviously I don't know your client's signature, but I do notice that the first line that identifies the person who's going to be signing it, that's left blank on the photocopy, I believe, that was admitted into evidence.
Yes, ma'am.
Was there any testimony about that blank?
No, ma'am, there was not testimony about the blank. There was testimony on the confusion of who the employer was, because she was actually hired by Denny's and didn't even know until, you know, we are preparing for the hearing who that was. She testified that she did believe she signed this. She did not dispute that. What she disputed was that she did not receive the documents that are listed on this. And I apologize, I didn't prepare copies of all of that, but I did have it with me. In the course of the petition, there were also other issues that were raised by the appellee. Mr. Tanner did not reach those, but I do want to at least make sure that I address them. They are fully briefed. But we also argued that even if the court had found that arbitration should be compelled, there were other reasons outside of the construction of the agreement and the enforceability. And those included the fact that we believe that the issue of arbitration had been waived based on the Perry factors. There are a long list of Perry factors, and I won't dwell on them. But this case, as of this week, we are now in our third year since it was filed, third year since the incidents occurred. It's been a very long process. We believe that the defendants have very effectively delayed the case and have used the litigation process even though they're asking for arbitration. There has been discovery, there were summary proceedings filed, continuances filed, we've been through three different sets of counsel. Those are all Perry factors that we believe go to waiver.
You say there were summary proceedings filed. Did the defendants file motions for summary judgment?
Yes, ma'am. So that I'm clear, other defendants, Sun Holdings and Denar LLC, filed summary proceedings. They were the management company who provided supervision and employment for the company for Denar Restaurants LLC. They filed summary pleadings saying they shouldn't be in the case. But of course, that meant that in order to do that, the appellant had to put forth her case in chief. Further, what happened in that, and it is also fully briefed, affidavits that were prepared by their witnesses were contradictory to affidavits that were presented in this case. So it depended on which part of the case they were dealing with, which way they gave their affidavit. And that was part of the Perry factors. We also talked about unconscionability and both procedural and substantial. But ultimately, for Appalee, we believe that whether or not we agree that Ms. King received the agreement, she says she did not, we believe that even if you construe the agreement, you don't get past step one. You don't pass go. You have to focus on the foundation of the agreement drafted by the appellant. And that is, she started work on the 11th, she left on the 19th, she did not continue under the 10-day rule, she did not continue employment after the 10-day rule. The judge did not abuse his discretion, and I think you can see it with a very full record that he did very meaningful and thoughtful questioning. He went through the entire procedure. He laid out a roadmap of what he thought was necessary in order to find that agreement could go into effect and it could go into arbitration, and none of that was resolved. Ultimately, the trial court gets to make the initial determination on whether this is an enforceable agreement, and he made the decision that it was not. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brandt. Mr. Tanner, rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a few points. As Ms. King's attorneys did in the court below, they continue to argue arbitrability issues. For example, counsel mentioned a claim not covered by the agreement, a claim or charge filed with a state or federal agency which would otherwise investigate or pursue a claim or charge, such as the EEOC or comparable state agency. That's a question of arbitrability. All these questions of arbitrability were argued below. The court made no such finding. But let me just point out that counsel's misrepresented that provision. That's found in 5B3I. And there's a proviso that says, however, a private right of action arising from or related to such claim or charge is a covered claim. This is a private right of action. The agreement recognizes that you can't compel the EEOC or a state agency, Fair Employment Practices Agency, to arbitration, but this clearly applies to the parties here because it's a private action. As far as the court being thoughtful in the way that it approached this, I would just urge your honors to look carefully at the record. First, there was a hearing set on the motion to compel, and the court said that Denar Restaurants was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing. We had to brief it. After we briefed it, the court said, yes, you are entitled to an evidentiary hearing. We got it. Then the court made an oral pronouncement on the record of the trial court's findings on January 25th at the conclusion of the two-day hearing, basically relying on the definition of course and scope of employment found in paragraph 2C. So that oral pronouncement was made. Later, in March, the court said, forget what the trial court said on January 25th. Those oral pronouncements were no longer valid or effective, and there were no findings at that point. The court asked the parties, the trial court asked the parties to present proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now, under the rules, the court did not have to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law, as we know. But both parties complied with the trial court's request, presented detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law, and then the court entered no findings of fact or conclusions of law, not one. So we just respectfully, we disagree that the trial court's approach here was thoughtful. It was all over the map. And I think that the trial court realized that it had gotten itself into a box with respect to this arbitrability issue. Finally, quickly, as far as counsel's argument that they didn't even know who Denny's was, they sued Denny's in January of 2011. Why would they sue a party if they don't know who they are? Denny's filed a motion for summary judgment because it didn't belong in the case. It was not an employer, and they quickly non-suited the claim. As far as waiver by litigation conduct, this case has been pending for quite some time. There were three changes of counsel for Dinar Restaurants. I don't think that those factors are listed as a Perry factor, but clearly Dinar Restaurants has not waived its right to seek arbitration by litigation conduct. Indeed, Dinar Restaurants has done nothing in this case except respond to actions taken by the plaintiff. Dinar Restaurants has not served one single request for admission, not one single interrogatory, not one request for production. It has not taken a single deposition. And there was a long period of time, 6 to 8 months, at one interlude where, frankly, there were no activities conducted by plaintiff, discovery or otherwise, and my client hoped that they had seen the light of reason and would dismiss what my client believes to be a totally frivolous claim. So we reject the argument that there's any waiver by litigation conduct, and certainly that was argued in the trial court below. Judge Evans made no finding in that regard. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Tanner. Ms. Brandt, we appreciate your arguments today and all of your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted and you all are excused. We will take a recess until we pick up with our 1:10:30 case. Thank you.